It's the same reaction as when I read that case, Veterans for Common Sense. At the time, it was versus Peak. And the case itself said that the veteran suicide rate was 18 veterans a day. And was like, why are people not up in arms about this?
This is SITREP, the New York City Department of Veterans Services podcast, where we aim to inform and inspire by bringing you the stories of New York City veterans, military service members, their families, and civilian supporters. I'm your host, Gabe Ramos, U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Deputy Press Secretary here at DVS. On today's episode, we chat with Coco Colhane. Coco is the founder and director of the Veteran Advocacy Project at the Urban Justice Center. You'll hear us chat about how she got involved in the veteran space and what it took to get the Veteran Advocacy Project off the ground. She'll talk about the pressing issues facing veterans and all the ways in which she and her team get them help, legal or otherwise. Enjoy the show. All right, so we are here with Coco Colhane. Coco is a founder and director of the Veteran Advocacy Project at the Urban Justice Center. She serves as an adjunct professor at Brooklyn Law School, where she teaches the Veterans Right Clinic. She also sits on Senator Gillibrand's Service Academy Selection Committee and is a founding advisor to the New York City Veterans Alliance. Coco, welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm really glad that you're here. We got a lot to chat about. Where I want to kind of start out is, though, is kind of pre-law. So obviously we know that you've been involved with the Veteran Advocacy Project, a lot of work with having to do with legal services and whatnot. But you were at the New Republic formerly. So you were 6 years there as an editor. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience there and how you kind of eventually worked your way into the law space.
Yeah, so I was at the New Republic. It was kind of my dream job. And, you know, I felt like I wasn't doing. I was sort of sitting back and commenting, or really editing other people's comments. And I wanted to be doing and affecting things and being like a part of change and be able to, you know, help reform various things. And I was interested in basically like the intersection of poverty and healthcare. I knew going into law school that that's what I wanted to pursue, and that I loved law school, and normally when people hear that, they want to slap me. They're just like, what? Because I think I went in really knowing what I wanted to get out of it, and it was a tool, and so I didn't have the same sort of like stress about.
So you went in there pretty clear-minded. You had a mission about kind of the direction that you wanted to go in.
Yeah.
So with that kind of being said, so you had this desire to really feel like you wanted to do rather than just kind of sit back and comment on. But while you were there, was there specific issues that you tried to kind of steer your work towards, or did you kind of didn't have too much control over that?
I didn't have a whole lot of control. I mean, I there was the presidential election, and then we did this long search for, I was working for the website. We did this search for we wanted an arts editor. And I kind of pulled a Dick Cheney where I was like, you know what? How about me? just an old reference. But yeah, so at the end, I was just, you know, like editing these writers. And it just, not that it wasn't terrific work. Mm-hmm. It just didn't, I wasn't passionate about it.
And so it wasn't really fulfilling.
It was, I was getting antsy.
Got it.
And they went through all kinds of like budget stuff and whatever, and it was the right time to get out.
Yeah, that was when it was the old New Republic.
Yes, before it was a before digitally right. integrated, whatever they call it now.
Yeah. So what was there? What was like the one thing you're like, all right, this is it's time for law school. It's time to make a change. Was there one specific thing, or was it just kind of gradual? Was it marinating in your head, and then you just kind of went that way?
I'd always wanted to go to law school, just as sort of an intellectual pursuit, and we would have these interns, they were reporter researchers who would come through, and I would sort of be jealous.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I'm so old, I can't go, you know. And it was, then suddenly it was just like, no, I can, whatever. I don't have to stay in this track. And called my boss and was like, I'm going to law school. He was like, wow, I didn't even know you had taken the L. So like, where are you going? I was like, no, I haven't done any of that.
I just made the decision. I know.
I always tell people when they're looking for career advice, like, don't do what I did in every way.
Right. No, I mean, I feel like, because, you know, when every time we talk about why folks join the military, there's a ton of reasons. It's either for money or to get out of their hometown, or it's, you know, sheer patriotism because they want to wear the uniform. Sometimes it's a family tradition. So I always kind of really find it interesting why folks get into the careers where they find themselves. And so you decided to go to law school. And so you kind of had that eye towards, you know, affecting change, social justice. So how did you really kind of land on the path that you ended up on?
So, you know, as I was picking sort of like internships and things like that, was focusing on health and this idea that, you know, taking care of each other is, you know, is a human right. And then I guess it was my second year, I was researching for a note topic and I came across this case, Veterans for Common Sense. At the time it was versus Peak. And the case itself said that the veteran suicide rate was 18 veterans a day. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and I've told this story so many times, but I literally almost fell off my chair.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe that this wasn't like on the front page of the New York Times every day. Like, how is this possible? And read about, you know, wait times for access to healthcare and then wait times on adjudicating claims. And it just really hit me how completely disconnected from the military and from service I was. So I looked for a place in New York City to volunteer, do an internship, something, and there wasn't anything. And it really just, like, I got it stuck in my head, like, there should be.
Right.
And yeah, people were like, go get a job, like, go try to find a job. Yeah. And I was like, no, I'm going to make this work.
So then how does that then turn into a reality? So, you know, you're really feeling these kind of strong feelings, you're very passionate about the work. How do you actually turn that now into this is something that I need to really make happen?
Yeah.
It's not there. How do you go about
it? No, it was definitely not there. So I ended up, you know, I sort of talked to a couple of places and then I heard about the Urban Justice Center had a mental health project. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after reading that case and following it, I knew that that was the way I wanted to contribute. Knowing from experience in my family and things like that, that when you're going through a mental health issue, trying to fight a bureaucracy is the last thing you should be dealing with.
Right.
So I felt like that's a way that I can be an advocate and can make an impact. So I went to the Urban Justice Center's mental health project and I said, give me a desk. You won't even know I'm here. I'll raise all my own money. I had no idea what I was saying at the time.
Right.
Again, another thing I tell people, like, don't do that.
Yeah.
And so just started really, they agreed to, they took a chance on me. And just started reaching out to every like veteran organization, anyone I could, saying, tell me about the need. What can I do?
What year is this now?
2010. And, I got detained in the VA. It was a very different time.
Wow.
It was right before they had shifted to embracing community partners.
Oh, my.
So they were like, what are you doing?
So what were you doing there? Exactly.
I was wandering around. I was trying to find someone in the social work. I think I was on, like, at the time, it was in 23rd Street, and they had a floor that was all social work. And I was just trying to find someone to talk to and say, you know, is there a way to collaborate? Is there something like, here's what I'm doing, here's what I put together? Yeah, and that's what I was reaching out to anybody. I'm one of the first partners, and we're still partnered with them today, is Jericho Project.
Yeah, of course.
So, and it all just really, I mean, it really was organic. It grew from there.
So, yeah, I think that one of the, you know, the good things about this kind of post 9/11 generation is that there has been this, you know, this groundswell of advocacy and passion and all these organizations propping up. So there's really no shortage of resources, benefits, care out there, especially here in New York City. I mean, the veteran community is so, you know, once you're in, you're pretty much plugged in.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of getting folks to the right places and making sure that they're aware of what's out there.
Eligibility
is obviously huge, killer. Especially in the legal space. So what comes next? So, you know, you're starting to form all these relationships, all of these partnerships. What kind of happens from there?
So I applied, I got a fellowship. So then I started getting a salary, which
there
was
you go.
Fantastic.
Yeah, gotta put food on the table.
Yeah. And started, taking cases and going to community meetings, service, you know, fairs, that different, I'm really trying to listen to what is the need. And so it started with me just doing, you know, I was doing like eviction and social security and just taking whatever was coming. And then, you know, kept applying for grants and really, because the need was there.
Right.
It was, you know, I mean, I would say a year or two later, other veterans projects started developing, which was fantastic.
Yeah.
There's still too much need.
Right. So this is 2012-ish around?
Yeah,
there?
2011, 2012.
Okay.
Started getting more grants, pitching ideas. You know, I read about, I think it was 2012 or 2013, the student veteran suicide rate is double the normal, you know, and so it was like, we got to get out to schools.
Right.
And so basically was getting grants and hiring people. My first hire was a Marine who was amazing, and we had some good times.
How'd you go out and find the Marine?
It was like, we put out a job posting, but it ended up being like somebody knew him through, like it was through a veteran network, yeah.
Of course.
And so then, you know, went to the executive director of the Urban Justice Center and said, what I want to do really goes outside the scope of the mental health project.
Yeah.
You know, we want to be reaching out to students. We want to be, I had just sort of come across this idea that discharges were this massive
right.
problem that no one was tackling anymore. So said we, he was like, you need to be your own project.
Yeah.
So we did that, which was also really terrifying because suddenly it was like, oh, people's
now
livelihoods.
Really have ownership over it.
Yeah, like yeah. I have to raise money. Like I got to pay people. Yeah. I got to make sure I can get, you know,
right.
the paycheck to them.
So was there something specific that kind of made you see? So obviously initially you got into it, you're working on this kind of mental health project and that's kind of your niche. Was there something that really kind of served as a catalyst that you said, oh, actually, no, it's the, it's a little bit more nuanced than just the mental health aspect and I need to start branching out into these other things.
It was just listening to the need.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really just, talking to community partners and looking at trends in referrals. The discharge issue was, a Marine who walked in with, I think like a child support problem.
Mm.
And I happened to see his DD-293, and you know, the reason I couldn't let him leave the office
yeah.
with the reason was like, I want benefits. And I was like, that's not a legal argument.
Right.
And I had no idea what I was doing, but I was like, I'm gonna find someone who does. And it really grew from there.
Yeah. So was there something like a major kind of caseload that you had initially in a kind of specific area, or was it just kind of a mixed bag of, you know, was it discharge upgrades? Was it,
So, I wanted to make sure I wasn't duplicating services and that
right.
we were, it was really, and we still are that way. We want to make sure we're filling the gaps.
Yeah.
Like what are the unique needs? So like the City Bar, Justice Center has a pro bono project that they work on disability compensation mainly. So right away I talked to them and said, let's have a referral partnership. And the Robin Hood Foundation funded us and Legal Services NYC. And we all worked together to make sure that we're not, you know, we're really being as efficient as possible.
Right.
I think we focused on working with some of the more vulnerable veterans.
Mm.
You know, there always has been a kind of mental health angle
yeah,
to the work.
For sure.
But it's in no way, anybody who calls us, we're going to help.
Right.
And
that help is in the form of either, you know, direct legal services or a referral. Since you're not saying, oh, I'm sorry, you know, you don't fit this criteria.
Right. I mean, if someone, there's no such thing as there's nothing we can do for you, sorry, and hang up.
Right.
Absolutely not. And there's no such thing as we're just going to give you a phone number.
Right.
You know, that's really annoying to some lawyers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've definitely had people who be like, this is social work.
Mm.
And we have an intake advocate whose entire job is making sure, following up on those referrals, making sure they're successful. And which is not to say that we can always find someone, that, you know, like family
yeah,
law is this massive unmet need.
Yeah.
Discharge upgrades are just, I mean, it's, I've lost a lot of sleep over our wait list.
I'm sure. So how do folks typically find you, or is it a bunch of different ways? Is it through the community relationships, through your network? Are you going out into specific spots and places and looking for folks?
It used to be. So it used to be me kind of wandering to shelters, going to Borden,
right?
Which, you know, at the time, I remember it was like me walking into a room full of like Vietnam vets, and they're just looking me up and down, sizing me like, what is she doing here?
Yeah.
And so I remember I just started making fun of myself and my name. And one vet started talking to me, and then others kept coming over. Yeah. And so it was really, that was a lot of our outreach at first, and through the VA, just working with therapists, social right. workers. And it's changed as the community's really gotten to know us as a resource. So we still have our intake line, but we have partnerships and contracts. And we don't do a whole lot. Like, we have too many cases. We have too many clients. So it's not like we're out there.
So it's not like you're sitting there with a shortage of
sadly,
of folks
no.
coming in. Yeah.
Yeah. And we do, you know, we have, right now we have partnerships with vet centers. Mm-hmm. So we're there once a week on site. So stuff like that, Jericho, Services for the Underserved. Yeah. So, I mean, I always say like, I hope you don't ever have to call us.
Right.
I hope we never see you again. But, unfortunately we have too many people.
So what would you say are the greatest, kind of challenges that you face, whether it's a specific, addressing a specific issue or, you know, what have you found to be the greatest challenge?
I think we've sort of become known for discharge upgrades. And I think in part that's because, so when we started doing it, I remember going and talking to John Rowan, the head of yep. Vietnam Vets, and, you know, him describing them doing the work in the 80s. And I was like, teach me, who's like, who's out there who yeah. can. And we ended up contacting David Addlestone, who's one of the founders of National Veterans Legal Services Program. Mm-hmm. In DC, and kind of tried to pull him out of retirement to come nice. Up and train us. And we did this huge training, a lot of volunteer attorneys. And, you know, I mean, he's the original. Like, he right. set up shop in Saigon and was like doing,
yeah.
You know, UCMJ work and stuff. So that was really exciting. And that's kind of, I think, a product of us also focusing on mental health, mm-hmm. Since so often there's that nexus with, you know, misconduct that got you discharged.
Right. So it's kind of, you have to trace it back to either the deployment or the incident and then kind of build a case from there. Or what does that really typically look like?
Yeah. I mean, so usually we'll have someone come in and a lot of times they're not ready to really talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, can I tell you about my favorite case?
Please.
So, this was a Marine. He'd served in Iraq. And so my students from Brooklyn Law School were doing the VA piece, so the character of discharge, to get him access to benefits and healthcare.
Right.
And we had a pro bono firm working on the discharge upgrade piece. We had been working with him a year, I think. And one of my students had just really made a connection with him. So we're working on... you know, the firm was, we'd set them up with a forensic psychiatrist to do this evaluation and talk about misconduct and why it was tied to PTSD. And I think he was also bipolar. You know, but it was before a lot of the reforms have come about making that easier now. But, and suddenly he opens up to the student and he said, you know, I was ordered to shoot upon this bus.
Wow.
And it was children. And I've never told anyone. I've never spoke, you know, I mean, it's something I can't even begin to comprehend.
Right.
But that was the case.
Yeah.
Right. Like, of course he has PTSD
right.
and moral injury. And
yep.
of course he started getting into fights and getting blackout drunk. I mean.
Impossible not to, yeah.
So it was just this amazing thing where suddenly, you know, you had all these people working on it. I think we had 3 students and we had this team of attorneys, and he was able to share that information and it made the case. And that's a lot of times, it takes a while. You've got to build that trust. You've got to build the rapport. And 'cause people are really sharing their darkest hour, their darkest moment.
Of course. So, I mean, so you're really, it's a personal thing. So, where you might feel kind of an inkling to just approach it very kind of systematically. We have to do this, this, and that. It's like you have to actually go out, build a rapport, establish that relationship, establish trust, and get them to the place where they're able to tell you these things, which is ultimately obviously going to serve to hopefully get their case moved forward.
We have the checklists, and we I should say the number one thing is that we want to make sure a veteran is working with someone, whether social worker, therapist, whatever, before we start the case, because we know we're going to be in some way re-traumatizing them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a must, and that can take years.
Right.
Like being ready to face all of that is a really tough thing. So we have a lot of people we check in like every 2 months.
Mm. Yeah, it's a long process. I would imagine. And so, what is your how do you kind of divide the responsibilities up amongst your team? Whether if you're having your students do certain things, but what does that process kind of look like typically?
We've changed a bit over the years. We used to have city housing contracts, and then I was like, we're chasing zip codes instead of serving people. So we got rid of that. So right now we have a staff attorney on discharges. We have one on VA. We have a general legal services who's really mostly housing. Another person who's coming in and is going to be general legal services, but also has some really terrific VA knowledge as well. And we have our intake advocate and me, and we're starting a new initiative to provide civil legal support to criminal justice involved veterans. Mm. So going out to Rikers, trying to talk to, people in the treatment courts.
Right.
And really part of it is just mapping out what's, we're not looking to reinvent the wheel here. It's like, what's out there? Yep. Where are the gaps? I mean, that's always, we're tiny. We're not serving, we're not legal aid.
It's a project, not a corporation.
Exactly. So it's really, where can we, what are the gaps and what can we do
What are our strengths? What are we good at? And what can we really, how can we really maximize our efforts?
Yeah, we don't ever want to half-ass anything.
Absolutely.
So I say no to some. We've had some really amazing sort of national level opportunities, and I'm just like, we don't have the bandwidth, And someday we're spinning off, so we're about to be our own entity, and I'm hoping we're going to grow.
Yeah, definitely. But you want to get out ahead of your skis. You want to obviously grow while you're still, keeping the same degree of still providing the level of service that folks are accustomed to.
Quality is important.
So obviously you had this, you started kind of nurturing this passion for veterans and the veteran space and service. So how do you go about kind of building the knowledge that you have to work within this space, so whether it's knowing VA regulations or, the different discharge characterizations of discharge. So how did you kind of go about that process of making sure that you were as well read on what you needed to be?
It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Cause no one was, the city bar was there doing sort of limited work. In the beginning. So I don't know if Swords to Plowshares in San Francisco was started by Vietnam vets, incredible organization, and they have a legal department. And so the head of their legal department in San Francisco was like teaching me. She was my go-to.
Yeah.
And then there's a Connecticut veteran. There are not a whole lot of organizations that are specializing in the legal arena. Yeah. And so on a national level, we all know each other. Mm. And it was really reaching out to people in far, far away places and being like, how does this work?
Right. So like I'm working on this kind of case. This is what I kind of need to know. What do you know about it? Have you worked on something similar? What's worked for you in the past?
Because the whole thing with the VA is you can know all of the regulations inside out.
Right.
And you can read all the case law. And you could have no idea how to do it. Yeah. Because there's so many quirks. And so it's really, that's where communication among lawyers is really important in teaching. Or not lawyers, just advocates.
Yeah.
Learning the idiosyncratic stuff and so that you can get whatever you're trying to achieve for that veteran, that's what's the most important. So I was talking to Commissioner Sutton, in fact, the other night about the fact that we're about advocacy and not, we're not the veteran legal project, right, you know, definitely. So whatever's going to get the job done.
Yeah.
Sharing those tricks with other advocates is what's important.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, what would you say is the thing that you find kind of most rewarding about the work? So obviously you set out to do this, you were kind of chasing, to address that, that real kind of internal need to really serve and make an impact and affect change. So, what would you say is the greatest reward? What do you love most about the work that you do?
I mean, the clients.
Yeah.
Just hands down, you know, I mean, and it's selfish, right? Like getting that, like seeing them, win, mm-hmm. right? Seeing them finally be recognized, whether it's an upgrade or, just getting benefits. It's like, it's validating. It's suddenly there's a little bit less stress, and getting to be a part of that is just incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And you know, and I have clients who have expressed their gratitude in just amazing ways over the years. And like one veteran gave me a flag, and on the back of the card, he'd signed his name. And then he wrote in parentheses, veteran, in case I, you know, like he wanted me to remember. And like, that's in my office and it's like my favorite thing in the world. So, just getting to see them get some justice and get that. Cause what we're doing is this tiny, boring stuff with statutes and regulations, but there's some healing that goes on.
Absolutely.
Which is just so powerful.
Yeah. And you're playing a small part in that, which
tiny,
is
tiny. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So if somebody were to kind of give you a magic wand and say, here, Coco, you could solve this kind of one issue or this one thing that's really serving as an obstacle, what would that be?
Just anything in the veteran space.
And yeah.
Veteran healthcare. Mm. I mean.
Access to,
you know, wait times, the privatization of the VA, I think, is threatening. Mm-hmm. You know, I could go into like my politics or whatever, but it's outrageous. Like the study that just came out yesterday, where they spent $57,000 of what was it, like $6 million on suicide
like
prevention?
Something insane like that. I mean, it's disgusting.
I feel rage.
Right.
It's unacceptable. And why has this been allowed to go on for decades?
Yeah, and the degree to which it's just kind of dismissed as like a, you know, this like little, whatever, we'll figure something out.
It's the same reaction as when I read that case, mm-hmm. and was like, why are people not up in arms about this?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that, you know, it's a cliche, but that military civilian divide. And when you have less than 1% of the country carrying this burden, mm-hmm. everyone else can ignore it. And so that's just, you know, a statistic. It's a dollar amount that nobody even cares about.
Right. Yeah, doesn't even make a dent really in the news outside of, you know, the folks who are kind of plugged in and tuned into it. So one of the things that I've picked up on, obviously in kind of talking to you and just seeing you in the work that you've done over the years, is that a lot of it is kind of built on, or it seems to come from a place of just rage, like you said, like a good rage, but it really is like this fire that's palpable in you.
Yeah. Well, I tell people when people are coming and asking like, oh, I want to do a fellowship or I want to, the first thing I say is, what makes you angry? Mm. What, because I think if you channel that, you know, it fuels you, right? It's fuel. And the best advocates, I think they're angry, but it is channeled and it's gotta be channeled. Yeah. Right. So, because otherwise it's not productive.
Right.
But I mean, I think that it's what should be different? Mm. And what are you doing about it?
Right.
Go do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't stand, people complain like, oh, I can't, it's go do it. Go do something.
Just get shit done.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And there's no shortage of things to keep that fire burning.
Sadly, yeah. We're not going to go out of business soon.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately.
Sad. It's sad.
This has been really a treat chatting with you. So the way we kind of generally wrap up the show is by asking the same two questions. So, if there is one thing you'd like every New York City veteran, service member, military connected, individual to know, what would that be?
it's a genuine thank you, mm-hmm. you know, and I know that thank you for your service is a sort of controversial. Some people don't want to hear it. So it's a very deep, heartfelt, no matter if you served a day or you did six tours, yeah. right? Like, thank you for raising your hand mm-hmm. and thank you for being willing, whatever your motivation, for being willing to step forward like that. And just, you know, there's so many clients who have hold so much shame about whatever may have happened in their service. Mm-hmm. And it, to me, it's like you've raised your hand. And so thank you yeah. very, very genuinely.
And for those folks not directly connected to the military?
There's a goddamn war going on. Several. I mean, it's wake up. And this is, don't tell me I don't support war. Mm-hmm. Guess what? We're a country and yeah. we are responsible as a country for what our government is doing, what our, and there are veterans all around you mm-hmm. and they're making it so that you can shop in Soho or whatever you're doing.
Or go to woodworking class.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's, you know, knowing how disconnected I was, mm-hmm. like, I didn't know that my dad served in the Army. Wow. I didn't find out till after this.
Yeah.
I started this project. So, I want to wake up other people.
Right.
And understand that, like, veterans are doing this, and what is your part? It doesn't need to be military, but a civic commitment.
Yeah.
And the way I want to do it, the way I'm doing it is saying, those people who raise their hand and they serve, we cannot turn our backs on them. We have to finish the contract. Absolutely. They served, we've got to take care of whatever their need is.
Yeah. Well, I think you're definitely doing it, and I'm extremely grateful for you, and I know a lot of the folks in here at the agency and in our community are you know, we're so grateful for you. So, and I'm super grateful for having you on. So thanks so much for being
here. Thanks for having me.
So if folks want to get in touch with you, is there email, social media, or for the organization?
Yeah. So we're at Veteran Advocacy. We're on Facebook, Twitter, veteranadvocacyproject.org. Do you want our intake line?
No, I think that works. Yeah. So, I mean, when we post it, we'll post
links. Social security number.
To the great. Yeah. No, that's really helpful. We'll make sure to spread the word out there. So,
yeah.
And if folks want to get in touch with us, we're at nyc.gov/vets. And we're on Facebook and Twitter at NYC Veterans. Thanks again, Coco, for coming on.
Thank you.
Cheers.